You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Our topic tonight is the filmmaker Woody Allen, and my guest is writer Eric Lax. Eric Lax is the author of many books, including a few books about filmmaker Woody Allen, a biography of Humphrey Bogart, one of Paul Newman, a memoir, and lots of other books and articles. And his latest is an in-depth documentary on the making of a film, and therefore on filmmaking in general. And it's called Start to Finish, Woody Allen and the Art of Movie Making. Eric Lax, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Jay. It's wonderful to be here.
Your new book focuses on the making of Woody Allen's film Irrational Man with Emma Stone and Joaquin Phoenix.
Right.
A movie that I suspect many of our listeners have never heard of, but that doesn't matter because you're writing about the process of filmmaking Woody Allen style, and you take us on this journey from Woody Allen lying on his bed writing the script by hand on a legal pad to Woody Allen lying on his bed writing the next script on a legal pad.
Thank you for noticing that. You know, what I did in the biography that I wrote of him that came out in 1992... I always use something in every book that I write to amuse myself that, you know, maybe I'm the only guy who gets. And in that book begins with him lying on a bed writing a film script in longhand and ends with him lying on a bed writing a film script in longhand. And because that's so much the process of what he does that I realized 25 years later, this, he's still just, you know, the wheel just keeps turning on this. So I just use the same little trope.
That's his cycle of life. How is this different than the process, I don't know if you know or can answer, of how other films are made? I mean, is Woody Allen's style a different kind of filmmaking? Because you talk about how in-depth he gets in every aspect.
Right. Woody's is different in a couple of ways. One is simply in the way the screenplay is presented, which he uses more of a shooting guide and a guide for the actors with their dialogue. Then most screenplays have lots of direction and things in them because it's going from a screenwriter to the studio to the director to all the other people. So lots of people need to be clued in on what's going on. And the writer, in most cases, does not have the authority which Woody has, which is total of every approval is his and his alone. He doesn't have to tell his backers what he's writing on or who's going to be in it or anything. And that's been the truth. That's been the case since he first started with Take the Money and Run. If I can go back for a second on that, in 1968, when the Palomar Pictures came to his managers, Jack Rollins and Charlie Jaffe, they said, what'll it take for you guy to write a picture for us? And Charlie Jaffe, who sort of handled what he would day-to-day on the film stuff, said, put $2 million in a paper bag, go away, leave us alone, and we'll deliver you a finished film. And that's really been the way he's operated for all these years since. So he's very different in that regard because really nobody in Hollywood has that kind of leeway that he has. One reason is because he does his films relatively cheaply by the standards of Hollywood. They're about $18 million. And the other is that over time, he's earned out on practically everything that he's done. Some have been obviously much more successful than others. The film at hand here, Irrational Man, was not one of the most successful that he had done. And in a way, I like the silver lining on this, that if you haven't seen the movie, then all I'll say is that you're in luck, because there's a small amount of tension that goes along with the story on here, and it's not resolved until the very last pages of the book, just because of the way the film is script. So the way the film was shot. So, you know, you're in luck. You've got a little bit of a storyline of tension there. So it's an extra added bonus for people who haven't seen it. I'm just getting that plug in there.
Is Woody Allen's attitude toward detail and kind of managing every aspect, is that a result of his experience on What's New Pussycat? I think that was the first movie that he was involved in.
Yes, exactly. So good for you. Yes, that's exactly right. He went there and he was hired to write this screenplay for Warren Beatty, and which he turned in, and then every day watched the lines just being massacred and things being turned around that he had no... that he had no say over whatsoever, and Charlie Feldman, the producer, was sort of the chief meddler in what went on. But everybody was sort of throwing in lines and what was going on. To the one point, Woody got, you know, really angry during rushes one day during dailies, and said, you know, you guys are just ruining this. But what he said, what he realized at the end, after this turned out to be the most successful comedy in terms of film gross in history, is that he said I could have made it twice as funny and half as profitable.
And it's interesting because both he and Warren Beatty came away from that film with the resolve that they would never do anything that they didn't control again.
Right, right. And that's and each of them had, you know, something so unique about them that they were able to do that. Beatty just, you know, for his presence and ability, and Woody because there's nobody who writes like him.
Well, Warren Beatty's made a handful of films, and Woody Allen has made 45 films, 44 films.
I think he's on 48 now. I can never keep track. So this was 44, 45, 46, 40. I think he's done 47, and 48 is in the 47, I think, is coming out on December the 1st, Wonder Wheel. And then the new one called A Rainy Day in New York is already edited and ready for next year.
How did you first get to know Woody Allen or get involved with writing about him?
In 1971, I was just starting out as a writer, and I was I'd been recommended to the New York Times Magazine, and we talked about three ideas that I might do, and one of them was Woody, who had just made the change from stand-up comedian to film director, and he had just come out with Bananas, his second film. And so the idea was I'd take a look at this. And I went to see him in his manager's office on 57th Street, and he was really very shy at the time. He still is now, but not nearly like he was then. And I had my list of questions, and I had my tape recorder, and I was very new to journalism, and I was nervous about seeing him because I liked his work, and I wanted this to succeed. And I forgot the principal thing about interviewing someone, which is turn it into a conversation. And so I raced through my questions. I made sure I asked every one of them. And he answered every one, and his shortest answer was no, which would have been fine, but his longest answer was yes. So I said, this is not going to be promising, and I ended up doing something else. And then a few months later, I was out in San Francisco and was nearly run down by a station wagon that had a card in the back saying, play it again, Sam. And he was out there making that. Herb Ross was directing it, but he had written it, of course, from his play and was starring in it with Tony Roberts and Diane Keaton. So we tried again, and I went to see him, and on a houseboat in Sausalito where he was scouting, and we talked, and then his manager came over to me and Charlie Jaffe and said, oh, he said, okay, you can come to the set, he said, but if you get in the way, you have to go. I said, okay. So I went and I sat in a corner for the first 3 days. I took the, sort of the salt lick for deer approach to this and said, I'll just get him used to me. And Tony Roberts came over and started talking to me, and a couple of days later, Woody came over and started talking, and we've been talking ever since.
And you mentioned your book, Woody Allen, a biography that was published about 25 years ago.
Right.
Yeah. And how did that book arrive?
That came along because I had, we had continued to talk between 1975 or 6. The odd thing of ways to go, so I wrote the piece for the New York Times Magazine, just to bore you to death with this, and I turned it in, after months and months of work on it, I turned it in the day the Time Magazine ran a cover story of him. So in journalism, as in comedy, timing is everything, and my timing was terrible. So it was the end of my piece. They just killed it. And I said, well, you know, I spent all this time on it, I might as well send it to him. And I said, send him a note and said, you know, thanks for all your time and for all the energy you expended on this. You might as well see what this was, you know, what the outcome was. And I didn't expect to hear from him. 2 days later, I had a phone call saying, gee, I'm really sorry about this. The timing was just so awful. I hadn't intended that to be the case. He said, your piece is really good. You've quoted me accurately and in context, and you've honored all my jokes. And by that, he meant, here's the first thing he taught me, was that the most important part of a joke is not the punchline, but the straight line. The punchline is useless unless the straight line is absolutely believable and hooks the listener. So I was really careful with any time I got to a joke for this, that I, you know, that I had the straight line just paved down as tightly as I could. And I think it was really because I honored the straight line that he said, you know, come on by if you ever want to talk or keep track. And I did, and I ended up going on his last tour as a stand-up with him, and a small publisher in New York had offered, I'd like to do a book with you. And I said, well, fine. And I gave them some ideas, and they said, well, you know, this Woody Allen thing is kind of interesting. And I said, well, you know, if we could do a book on, you know, if we want to do a book on comedy, if you want to do it through a guy doing this, we could kind of use him as a way of exploring it. So I wrote this book called On Being Funny that came out in the mid-70s. and figured I was done with him. And then in 1987, my publisher of my next book had gone, the editor of that had gone to Knopf and was taking me with him, and the idea for this book came up, and we said, okay, let's try that. And so I wrote this biography that came out in 92, as you mentioned. And I figured I was really done with him then. And but it turned out that after seeing him early in the career and kind of this midlife biography that I had done, it was sort of interesting to both of us that nobody had ever really followed somebody along really all the way through their career. I had this really rare opportunity to see an artist at work from really the beginning of his career on. So we continued to talk, and then the conversations with Woody Allen came along 10 years ago, and then this came along. So it's been, you know, there'll be a lot of books better about Woody Allen that'll be better than anything I can do. But what I've done and what other writers are going to have to use in the future is I have thousands and thousands of pages of transcript of him talking on the record at the time that he was doing it. So I have 46 years of transcripts of him. So if you want to know what he was thinking at a certain time, nobody has to go back and remember it. It's written down. And that will be, you know, in the library someplace after I finish.
And so maybe you still have more to say about Woody Allen.
Well, since I've said I'm done so many times, I'm not going to say I'm done. that's not proved to be a worthwhile thing. So we'll keep on talking and see what happens. So it's been wonderfully enjoyable. He's after the dismal performance my first time with him, I actually stopped to let him answer the question and engage him in conversation, and he gives me whole paragraphs as answers. So it's a pretty nice way to spend time.
Well, I'm an admirer of his work, and you mentioned his stand-up, and his stand-up work was so wonderful and so slightly bizarre. And you hint in your book that maybe he would return to stand-up. Is he still thinking about that?
It comes, you know, I think it's less that there was a period when he was making Irrational Man, and this was the summer of 2014. He had seen Mort Saul, who had come back at nearly 90 to perform. And he'd always been so, it's really because of Mort Saul that he became a stand-up. He saw that you could have, that somebody could come out with these kind of original, iconoclastic, idiosyncratic jokes that were not wife jokes, you know, she's so fat that, or it's so hot that, or, you know, not that boom, 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 Gatling gun kind of approach, but jokes to kind of start off in real life that start off with just an absolute premise based in the news and then go wildly off into satire. And that really showed him that there was a place for his kind of humor. And he said, you know, gee, if Saul is doing it this age, and then he said, you know, it's going to take me a year to do it, and, you know, I'm going to have to go back, and I can't do it like I did before because I've led a very public life, so I'm going to have to start saying, you know, well, a lot of things have happened since you last saw me, and I've made these movies. And he said, you know, you have to write the material and write the material and hone it, and he says, the better part of a year to get an act. He said, and I don't know if I could fit it into doing film work. So I think it's kind of, you know, it was a nice idea for him for a while, and he enjoyed playing with it, but I don't see it happening. But I would never say it's not going to happen, because he's always full of surprises, and I kind of hope he does figure out a way to do it.
It would be fun.
So anyway, we'll see. But it's I know that it you know, he has a very interesting observation about stand-ups. He says that if he has a style in movie directing, the Woody Allen style comes down really in terms of what he wants from his actors. His object as a director is four words: make it sound natural. If the dialogue sounds natural, you can say it however you want, so long as it sounds natural. And it's the same thing with stand-up, because the whole thing that you do as a stand-up is that you're there, it's you naked in front of this audience. I mean, this time of the way things are going this year, I can't say this. It's, you know, it's the performer up there, you know, just himself or herself in front of the audience. And there's no barrier between you, and your whole job is to make yourself believable in a way that the story you're telling them, that you will suck them into them and you will take them on a ride, that they suspend disbelief and they know at some point that you're going to make them laugh. But you have to as he said before, the straight line has to be really perfect or you're not going to get them there. And so he said what that does, he says it's not a coincidence that a lot of stand-up comics are very good actors, because they've learned that they have to get up there and sell themselves in this absolutely natural way to the audience. So when he has comedians in parts for him, Andrew Dice Clay or others who would come along, they're very good at doing their parts because they know how to make it sound natural, and they'll almost never ask if they can change something. The one person who did was Andrew Dice Clay, who said, I know what you want here. He said, I can say it better if you don't mind if I do it like this. And he said, sure, you know, do whatever you want. And he got the natural reading that Woody liked.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is KSCO in Santa Cruz. And tonight I'm talking with Eric Lax. He's the author of a new book called Start to Finish, Woody Allen and the Art of Movie Making. Even before your book was published, there was press related to new revelations in your book about the allegations of sexual abuse that have been leveled at Woody. And since your book was published, there hasn't been a day when those kinds of allegations haven't been made about a host of celebrities and politicians.
Right.
And although your book is 99.9% about other things, I mean, you do spend a little time on the case, so let's talk about it a little.
Sure.
You're personally convinced that Woody Allen did not act improperly with his children.
Yes, and I base it on the following. I've read all the depositions, I've read all the police reports, I've read the psychiatric reports, I've read the Yale New Haven reports, I've read all the evidence that has come through. In addition, one of the reasons that I and each of those not only proclaimed him innocent, they just said there's nothing here to go forward on. It's not that he was exonerated, it's that he was never charged. In four separate instances, there's been an investigation into him, and in four separate instances, they're saying there's nothing here to charge him with. And I think it's important to remember that. He's somebody who's led a life in the public eye for 60 years now. I would say a couple of things about this. One is that child molesters do not strike once, and then you decide at age 50 to become a child molester and then never do it again. Secondly, I can't believe we're talking about this kind of stuff. And the second thing is that in the course of doing this, Woody's adopted son Moses, who was 13 at the time that the allegations were made, came to me when I was writing this and said, I have a story to tell that's not been told before, in which he's quite specific in debunking a great deal of how the charge is made, and also talking about a household in which Mia Farrow was terribly controlling and demanding and scripting what her children would say and how they would do it. It's quite chilling, I think, in what he's had to do. And also Linda Fairstein, who is now a best-selling author, but for 28 years was the head of the sex crimes unit for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, saw all the material. And because at the time that the case was going on, even though it took place in Connecticut where the charge was made, they both lived in New York, so she thought it maybe would be coming to her as well, so she was careful to just keep track of what was going on. And she said there's nothing that I've seen regarding this case that makes me believe for an instant that this event happened. And I'm persuaded by that. I think one of the proofs of that, as far as I'm concerned, is you were saying, you know, not a day goes by with somebody not coming out of the woodwork and making a charge. Harvey Weinstein, is these allegations come out against him. Suddenly there are 200 people saying, yes, it happened to me as well. Bill Cosby, the same thing. Louis C.K., the same thing. One allegation was made by a quite understandably very upset and unhappy Mia Farrow in 1992 when Woody took up a relationship with Suni, who was of age, who was not his adopted daughter. He was not a father figure to her. He did not live in that house. They lived in separate places. And certainly she was aggrieved by this relationship. And I will also say about this relationship is that even though they've been together for 25 years now, is that Humphrey Bogart says in Casablanca, of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the world, she walks into mine. And I would say of Woody and Suni, of all the women in all the world, this is the one he ends up with. It was highly irregular. Some people would say it was transgressive. It was not illegal, and it was a match in which he has said many times over the years a word that I'd never heard him use before, which is that he was content, not only in love, but he had found contentment with somebody. Now, that still caused huge havoc in the household, and I'm not denying that for a second. But I do believe that that these charges were maliciously fabricated, and that one of the reasons that I feel that this is true is that with all the charges that have come out against everyone else, there's been no second charge against Woody. He's been in the public spotlight for 60 years. There were these serious charges leveled against him. Nobody has come to him and said, oh, yes, when I was a kid, he did this to me. No actress he's worked with, nobody has ever worked with, has said he's never, you know, oh, yes, he came on to me or he did this. He's not behaved in an improper way in any way that has been charged against him in all of these years of public life. So I think I know that people are very upset with him. I know it's a very compelling story. And one of the things that Moses pointed out to me, whose bedroom was on the second floor where this alleged abuse took place, although there are three places where it was alleged, finally is alleged to have taken place upstairs in an attic room with an electric train. Moses said there's no electric train in that room. And Mia Farrow describes it in a deposition as being in a narrow room where the eaves comes down, where it slopes, so it's cut off at a 45-degree angle. And so it's a triangular room in which there's simply not a place to put an electric train. So however heartfelt the accusation is, and I believe that she believes it entirely, that Dylan believes it entirely, because I believe she heard the story again and again and again. We hear Ronan Farrow, who's 4 years old at the time, a month after the abuse allegation is made, is heard saying to people, my father is fucking my sister. A four-year-old is saying this to people. Now, there's only one place he's hearing that, and he's heard that again and again and again. So I do have, as I say, I've read all the material, and I talk about it at some length in the book, and it's laid out as clearly and concisely as I can. I don't think anybody cares what I feel about this, because they'll say, well, of course, Lax, he's known him for 45 years, and he's in cahoots with him, and you know, Woody's charmed him, and he owes his career to writing books about him. And I just say that's simply not the case. I've written books about many other subjects, but the truth is, show business books are not my métier. I really write books about science, which is where the most pleasurable books I enjoy these, but books that I'm very proud of were done in the field of science. And moreover, if I thought if Woody was culpable in any way of this, I would have stopped the relationship. I wouldn't want to continue writing. I would write other things, so that's my best answer that I can give.
And it's a good one. Thank you. You wrote a book, you co-wrote a book on Humphrey Bogart, right?
Yes.
And Bogart, when he met Lauren Bacall, he was, what, 45 or 46? And she was...
Yeah, she was 20. He was 25 years older than she, yeah.
So, it's, you know, and in Hollywood, that sort of thing isn't that unusual. Of course, she wasn't the adopted daughter of...
Right. And, you know, as I say, without trying to mitigate this in any way, Woody's films are almost always, or a large majority of them, about the unpredictability of love. This is certainly unpredictable love. It certainly was disruptive love. But it certainly also has had... an outcome that has been, for the two of them anyway, very good, and also the two daughters who they have adopted, who I'd also say there's no way that the adoption agent, at state adoption boards, would allow the adoption, especially of a girl, to somebody they had any secondary feelings of mistrust about, as far as child abuse was concerned.
Well, also in this day and age, we're like looking back at things in a new light, and Manhattan, which is, you know, one of Woody Allen's masterpieces,
right,
tells the story of a man who's in love with a 17-year-old
right,
girl.
Right.
And then he doesn't, in the end, you know, he doesn't want her to grow up. That's like, he doesn't want her to not be the thing that he loves. And
yeah. It's true. You know, at the time, I remember when the film came out, I thought, gee, that's sort of an odd story. And the movie was wildly embraced. You know, nobody's had anything to say about it in terms of objecting about it. It was hugely successful. And now looking back, it's, you know, there's a sinister, more sinister motive attached to it. Woody did have a a relationship with somebody who was of age, and that people have tried to go back and get her to say, oh yeah, you know, I was really underage when I was seeing Woody, but you know, wouldn't have anything to do with it. But there's a difference between, you know, somebody who's of the age of consent taking up with somebody who's older at a time when that was more common than it is now and is looked at in a different way than it is now. And that's just largely in the history of relationships, is there's been a great deal of disparity. I'm not defending it, I'm not doing anything, there is certainly a sea change in how we look at the relationships between older men and younger women than we have in the past. I say that. It's certain, you know, with Bogart, he was certainly old enough to be Lauren Bacall's father, and she was really a lifesaver to him. He was in this terrible, dead-end, violent marriage with an actress named Maya Metho, who was alcoholic and filled with rage. And they fought publicly. She had stabbed him on a couple of occasions with a knife. She gave him a new lease on life. It was terrible for Mayo, who went on and died of acute alcoholism a few years later. So, I mean, it's, you know, what can I say? I'm not, I don't know what else to say.
Well, you know, there's a whole lot of things in films that, you know, we accepted as perfectly fine when we watched them. And now looking back on them, you know, with today's enlightenment, you know, we find them
right.
Difficult.
We say, gee, how could we have believed that? How could we have felt that that was the way to do it?
Yeah.
And so I think there's often a problem of kind of misequivalencies of things, that you judge a movie from 50 years ago. I'm not talking about Matthew, but you take something that happened 50 years ago and you look at it in the light of today, you say, well, that's not acceptable today. And so you judge the people with the lens of today as opposed to you do with the time, with the lens of the time and how things were accepted.
Speaking of Manhattan, though, that Manhattan is a really an interesting movie in Woody Allen's career, because I think it's the turning point. That is, Annie Hall, which is a fabulous movie too, but Annie Hall is a comedy that's very serious, whereas Manhattan is a drama that is funny.
Yes, exactly. That's a nice way to put it.
And all the movies that he's made since Manhattan are in some way that kind of film. He's made some outright comedies, but mostly they're serious films with humor in them.
Yes. Yes, I think that's so. And where he really tried to do just the straight out and out comedy, which was Curse of the Jade Scorpion, he would say that, as far as he's concerned, that's his least successful film. That's the one he thinks that he really failed to cast on, that he was the wrong person to be in it. Which he did at the last moment because the actor who was supposed to do it had to drop out. But he said, I talk about it in the book, of how he feels where he went wrong on that. But that's a movie that was meant really for laughs and fell flat for the audiences, although it was a huge success in Japan, so go figure.
Well, now you wrote a book about the history of comedy, or the nature of comedy.
Right, I was interested. You know, not being funny, I was trying to figure out how humor works without doing. There was a wonderful writer named George Eastman in the 1930s who wrote a book about humor. And I believe it's Walcott Gibbs in The New Yorker said in the review of it, Mr. Eastman has got humor down, and I'm sorry, Mr. Eastman has got comedy down and broken its arm. And I was trying very hard not to do that, because I figured nobody cares what I have to say about comedy. But if you have somebody who's a comedian talking about comedy, then maybe you get a sense of what goes into it. So that was the point of that book. It was a look at him at work, but really trying to explain how comedy is done.
Well, it leads to my next question. So after Woody Allen finished the film that you're writing about in this fabulous book, Start to Finish, Woody Allen and the Art of Movie Making, Eric Lax, he did a television series for streaming television with Elaine May and
yes.
Miley Cyrus. And the material in the first episode, anyway, is extremely funny. I mean, it's really funny. The scene is he's in a barbershop.
That barbershop is one of the barbershop chair. I'm with you. It's certainly the funniest thing in that whole episode.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, even though it's funny material, it's not really working. It doesn't. What do you think is wrong? Why isn't it funnier?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, that's an idea that he had been talking to me about for years. You know, people think that one of the criticisms of Woody is that when he writes a film a year, he just sits down and he knocks off whatever there is, and then whatever he has there, he goes off and makes it. And if he just took more time, he could make more consistently better films. Well, two things wrong with that. First of all, nobody makes a masterpiece every time out. And secondly, he doesn't write a fresh script. He does write a fresh script every year, but invariably, it's an idea that he's been working on and off for years that he got to a certain point, and then he says, you get to the point where you say, what's next? So he uses the example of the Purple Rose of Cairo, where the character comes down off the screen and gets involved into the life of the woman. And he says, well, great. He said, you've got an idea. The character comes down the screen and gets involved in the life of the woman. What's next? And he couldn't figure out what happened next. So he shelved it. It took 10 years before he figured out that when the character not only gets involved in life, but the actor playing the character also becomes involved with it, then you've got something to play with. So, and it, the point of the film is that reality is always disappointing. Reality is not, in the end, going to make you happy. But and that as much as we love fantasy, where we can be happy, you're stuck with the reality of reality. So, and that's really the case every year. There'll be something he was back, and he'll rework something, and it'll come. Sometimes he's written three film scripts in a very short period, working off other ones before he found the one that he wanted to do. So there's that kind of misconception about what he does. And I forgot where I was going with it.
Why isn't this last one funnier, even though
why
the material
is this last one funnier? Because I think in the end is that even, as he points out, you know, you think, on paper, you love it. It's there, and it's working very well. He, as I said, he'd been talking about this off and on for, gosh, 6 or 7 years I've been hearing about this script. He said, I don't know whether to do it as play. I don't know whether to do it as a movie. And he goes back and forth. And finally, this thing with Amazon that came along that he had very mixed feelings about. On the one hand, it was such a ridiculously generous offer because he kept saying no because he didn't really want to do television. And then finally, his manager said, look, they've given you everything you want. You're never going to, you know, you can't have anything more than they're giving you to do. He said, yes, you're right. He said, I better do it. And the problem for him, he's not very good at doing episodic things. So what might have worked as a straight line through, in this you had to come full circle every half hour. You start off, you've got a premise, you move the story along, you have to come to an end, you basically have the end of Act 1. And then you have to pick up again. So you have to have, in this case, six acts. It's a, you know, crisis in six scenes is what it's called. And for him, that was a problem. You had to wind it down so you could wind it back up again. And I think that's a way of writing that he's not effective at. That he did episodic things. He did one-offs, actually, when he was doing television writing in the 1950s and early 1960s. He wasn't even doing episodic television. He was doing sort of specials for people. So it was a way of writing that was new to him. And I think it the kind of discipline you need for that it was something that he didn't quite have the experience to pull off it. You know, it's interesting. Until you asked me the question, I've been wondering what went wrong with it. But I really think that's it, because when he was writing it, he was talking about it. He said, what's so annoying about this is you just get going, and then you have to halt it, and then you have to start it up again. And so I would suggest that that's probably the reason that it didn't work as well as it might have.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Eric Lax. He's the author of Start to Finish, Woody Allen and the Art of Movie Making. Woody Allen's audience sometimes has a hard time with him. If makes me think of Manhattan again. I remember going to see Manhattan at the theater with great anticipation because Annie Hall had been such a remarkable picture. And in the opening of Manhattan, there's a monologue. It's different than the monologues that he had done previously because it's a writer writing out loud, essentially.
Right.
And it's not funny. But audiences were laughing hilariously because they thought it was going to be funny.
Right. And part of it is, you know, it's the start and stop of that. You're hearing, Woody says that he likes to, he goes on at some length about this in Start to Finish. He talks about how he likes to use narrative because, among everything else that's happening on the screen, you've got a chance to hear what's going on in the mind of the character. And so when he's off screen giving you this narration, you're seeing these beautiful shots of Manhattan, you know, coming on with all this sort of stuff. And you hear the writer, you hear the character trying to tell the story. And you think, no, that's not going to work. And you become kind of caught in that. So the amusement and the fun of it is hearing the start and stop of it. And each time you do it, you're seeing a different slide. Because it's a different way of looking at that material just through the eye of the narrator. So as you're hearing, you see this character one way, then you see him another way, then you see him a third way. And that's what's sort of funny about it. Because you hear kind of you hear him say, no, this is not quite working, but you hear the coiled cat and all that. You know, you're just, it's self-deprecatingly funny. And you're getting a sense of how the character is being formed by what the writer is trying to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So let's just talk for a minute about his earlier films, the ones that came before Annie Hall, that were just chock full of jokes and hysterically funny and more like, I think he's called them cartoons than...
Yeah, verbal cartoons, yeah.
And those films are still, you know, immensely popular. And yet, like I said, I don't think very many people saw Irrational Man.
Right, and you sort of wonder, why. He has a Woody Allen film is as reliable as the summer solstice. You know, you just have to look around and you'll find one. 2014 was a bad year for him. That was the year that the Dylan's heartfelt letter was published in the New York Times, and I think there was some residual reticence on the mind of people for that. Also, it didn't get rave reviews. It was coming on. He had done Midnight in Paris, which had been a huge success, followed by Magic in the Moonlight, which had been sort of okay, and then he wanted to follow it. He had this sort of serious film that he wanted to do. And it just didn't, you know, it just didn't click. He would, I think in the end, it's unfortunate because I think it's a much better film than people have given it credit for. In the same way that people go back and look at Interiors, which was his first truly serious film, which he did...
Right after Annie Hall.
Mm-hmm. That it was so kind of out of context for him, nobody quite knew what to do, and they could see Bergman in it, but they didn't see the rest of the that was so good about it. And I think in this one too, it's a really interesting. It's a slightly comic in the sense of it's so the premise is so wild. Here's a burned out philosophy professor who's alcoholic, has no will to live, and suddenly finds purpose in after he's overheard a woman bemoaning the unfair judge in the custody battle that she's in, who's completely sided with the lawyer of her ex-husband, who's done nothing to support the kids, nothing to help them, but they're in cahoots, and the judge is only making it harder on this woman. And the philosophy professor, Joaquin Phoenix, is thinking, you know, I can make your life better for you, lady. Somebody kills this guy, nobody's going to think it's me because they don't know him. You'll get a different judge, can't be any worse, probably better, and maybe you'll have a better outcome. So it's this, first of all, this really improbable sort of notion, but it's for kind of the perverse thinking of everything from, from Lindbergh kidnapping, sort of superior thing about, well, I can commit the perfect crime and pull it off.
Strangers on a Train comes to
mind. Or Strange on a Train, Le Beau Serge, any of these. And it's a, so you set it up as kind of this psychological drama like that. And it's, you know, you get pulled into it, but he originally was going to call it, the professor's name is Abe. And if you look closely on the cover of the book, I'm sorry to be hawking my book here. If you look on the cover of the book, there's a picture, and at the very top of the cover, there's the first page of the first draft of the handwritten script for this. And it says, what are we talking about here? That's the first line of the movie, and that's a voiceover by Abe. But if you look up on the far left-hand corner, you see there's a little in small words that says Crazy Abe. And for a long time, all the way through this, that was his idea for the title of the movie. He usually doesn't get titles until the end. And he kept thinking, Crazy Abe, Crazy Abe. And he hadn't told anybody else about this. And he was all set to do it, and finally, both people on his team and also at Searchlight, we're saying, Sony Pictures Classics, we're saying, you know, it just makes it sound a little fanciful. It makes it sound slightly comedic to call it Crazy Abe or drama like that. And so we ended up calling it a rational name, because the problem for him is he does anything and people think it's comedic. So there are lots of lines in Blue Jasmine, for instance, where people laugh. He said, there was never a laugh meant to be there. He said, but people think it's because of me. If there's ever an excuse to laugh, they'll take the idea that it could be comic as opposed to serious.
Like that opening monologue in Manhattan.
Yeah, exactly. So you just, you know, that's the, you know, curse is the wrong word for this, but it's a limitation that is placed on him sometimes.
Because of those early films.
Yeah, you're so used to him, you know that he's so funny. And, you know, for him, comic films were always really meant to be a stepping stone to writing drama. He always wanted to be a dramatist. He wanted to write dramatic plays. That was always his hope. And he said, you know, give me an evening in the theater. He says, I always want to see the drama. I'd much prefer that over comedy. He said, but I can write comedy. And it's easier for me, and people respond to it. And, you know, I'm not blind to that I have a knack for doing this. And he said, but I want to stretch myself as much as I can, and I hope that people will, you know, that some of my dramatic ideas are good enough that people will be willing to go with me on them.
Even Invaders from Space, believe is
earlier. Even your earlier, funnier ones, you know. That, you know, we like your movies, especially your earlier, funny ones.
I thought when Interiors came out that it was A Woman in Paris, the Chaplin film.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, and it's just, you know, he's got Bergman shots in it, he's got all kinds of, but it's, you see him taking what he's learned about cinematography and making films and trying to apply it to his own skill and to grow as he goes along. There was a moment when he was making Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, which was his the third film that he directed right after Take the Money and Run, which, as I said, was done by Herbert Ross. And there was this Italian sequence that's in there that's actually quite serious. It's just done in the style of Bertolucci. And he's his set designer, Dale Hennessy, who was really wonderful, was trying to build this, and he kept saying what he wanted to do. And finally, one day, he turned to me and he said, you know, the butterfly has come out, and he has red hair, which was that suddenly he was going for the serious. Even in the comic, he was going for the serious. And I always thought that was so funny.
Is Woody Allen a funny person?
He's funny when he wants to be. And here's the, when you're talking with him, we'll be doing our interviews, and he can be funny anytime he wants, you know. So, but he's not on. He's not a comedian trying to constantly score. But what he will do is that, all of the tapes that I have, and if you look at the conversations that we have in the book, he'll go along for a while. He'll be quite serious, and he'll go sometimes a couple of paragraphs, and then he'll say, need something self-deprecating, and he's really taken the art of self-deprecation to a high order of art. That he'll do something self-deprecating just to deflate it a little bit, so that he's not seeming to pontificate for too long, and then he'll go on. And he'll be very serious again, but he'll puncture the balloon. And there's kind of an instinctual point that he has in doing it where he thinks he's said he's been serious long enough.
He said of his movie Bananas, the movie is about the lack of substance in my movie.
Yes. Well, you know, within that, everything, that's something that was totally devoted to the laugh. He didn't care what it looked like. He didn't care how it was lit. All you wanted to do was to get the joke up on the screen. And if you look at really jokey comedies, they're always brightly lit. They're not beautifully shot. What they are is they're brightly lit. They're unsubtle. They get the joke up there, and they get it out there, and they get the laugh, and they move on to the next. And for him, of course, he wants the subtlety of cinematography along with the subtlety of the script.
And the process of making a film is detailed so well in this book, and it's called Start to Finish: Woody Allen and the Art of Movie Making. And the author, my guest, Eric Lax, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on the book.
Oh, Gary, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Eric Lax. His latest book is called Start to Finish, Woody Allen and the Art of Movie Making. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.